Welcome to the Republican Professor. I'm your host, Dr. Lucas J. Mather. Today is Thursday, 11 September 2025, years after Jesus. Got a reading from Streams in the Desert, January 4th. This is a 1925 edition, the original. Purchased at Beachtown Books in San Clemente, across from Pizza Port. Jesus saith unto him, Go thy way. Thy son liveth. And the man believed the word that Jesus had spoken unto him, and he went his way. John 4:50. When ye pray, believe. Mark 11:24. When there is a matter that requires definite prayer, pray till you believe God, until with unfeigned lips you can thank Him for the answer. If the answer still tarries outwardly, do not pray for it in such a way that it is evident that you are not definitely believing for it. Such a prayer, in place of being a help, will be a hindrance. And when you are finished praying, you will find that your faith has weakened or has entirely gone. The urgency that you felt to offer this kind of prayer is clearly from self and Satan. It may not be wrong to mention the matter in question to the Lord again if He is keeping you waiting, but be sure you do so in such a way that it implies faith. Do not pray yourself out of faith. You may tell Him that you are waiting and that you are still believing Him, and that therefore praise Him, and therefore praise Him for the answer. There is nothing that so fully clinches faith, I'm on the top of page five now, as to be sure of the answer that you can thank God for it. Prayers that pray us out of faith deny both God's promise in His word and also His whisper, yes, that He gave us in His heart, in our hearts. Such prayers are but the expression of the unrest of one's heart, and unrest implies unbelief in reference to the answer to prayer. Quote, For we which have believed do enter into rest. Hebrews 4:3. This prayer that prays ourselves out of faith frequently arises from centering our thoughts on the difficulty rather than on God's promise. Abraham, quote, considered not his own body, unquote. Quote, he staggered, not at the promise of God, unquote. Romans 4:19-20. May we watch and pray that we enter not into temptation of praying ourselves out of faith. That's from C.H. P. I don't know who that is. It's not California Highway Patrol, I can tell you that, because it's 1925. Faith is not a sense, nor a sight, nor reason, but taking God at His word. And that's from Evans, whoever that is. Maybe there's an index with these names, I don't know. The beginning of anxiety is the end of faith, and the beginning of true faith is the end of anxiety. George Mueller. You will never learn faith in comfortable surroundings. God gives us the promises in a quiet hour. God seals our covenants with great and gracious words. Then He steps back and waits to see how much we believe. Then He lets the tempter come, and the test seems to contradict all that He has spoken. It is then that faith wins its crown. That is the time to look up through the storm and among the trembling, frightened seamen cry, I believe, God, that it shall be even as it was told to me. Believe and trust, through stars and suns, through life and death, through soul and sense, his wise paternal purpose runs. The darkness of his providence is starlit with divine intents. That's January 4th, Streams in the Desert. Streams in the Desert, this edition. What I love about this is it's got little artwork at the beginning. You see this little artwork here? It's vintage, man. It's so great. This is an old thing from 1949. It's the 29th printing of the first edition. It's got this little note in here that's very old. I'm not going to take it out. Miss Chase E. Coman, through waves and clouds and storms, he gently clears the way, is the quote in the front. Kalman Publications, Post Office Box 9812, Los Feliz Station, Los Angeles 27, California, 1949. But the copyright is 1925. It's the first printing. It's not the first printing. It's the first edition. There's some politically incorrect stuff in here, but it's not offensive. It's just, you know, it's only offensive if you look to Democrats to tell you how to think and how you believe. And by the way, a lot of you Republican parents who are so excited about your kids getting Democrat diplomas, I think are morally culpable. Whoever invented the so-called distinction between heart and head knowledge and started shopping that around, I don't know who that was, but I'm saying I don't think it's a guy, but pretend it was a guy that woke up one day and he, you know, there's a difference between head knowledge and heart knowledge. I'm going to make sure as many people believe that as possible, and goes around the country getting half the churches to believe it. That's the only reason that Charlie Kirk had any job to do, is because he was correcting really basic fundamental errors that any decent parent or grandparent could have fixed in childhood. The fact that the parents and grandparents are not equipped, probably because of some weird distinction between head knowledge and heart knowledge that's not biblical. And then you send your kid in the lion's den and you wonder why they're surrounded by lions. And some of them get eaten. We have a reading from The Age of Entitlement, America 6 to 60s. I've told you about this. We're just going down the list of stuff. We're just continuing the work here. But on that note, I wanted to say about head knowledge versus heart knowledge. Charlie did a bang-up job in so many ways, and his work is going to continue. But to see so many spectators watching this as if it's some kind of sporting event is somewhat troubling to me, because the impression is that it's something you're born with. It's not something you're born with. There's a way to get head knowledge, which is what Charlie had mastered to a large extent and displayed it, at least in some of the first iterations. What you don't see is some of the deeper conversations that come up later once they're thinking about what Charlie said. There's further work that needs to be done. And if you walk away thinking that this is something you can just get on Twitter, or you can watch some videos or TikTok or something And that's how you get it. And some people get it, some people don't. No, that's completely wrong-headed. It's not a spectator thing. It's something that requires effort, and that it's something that you yourself will be at war with. And you have to recognize that as such. The biggest obstacle you have to becoming competent in the matters of head knowledge, where it really helps, is yourself. Your own short attention span, your own sense of entitlement, your own probably false beliefs about head knowledge versus heart knowledge, or the value of a degree, or whatever slogans you're used to saying. Yeah. Why would you study logic? Why would you study anything besides how to make money? And here we are. The age of entitlement. Chris Caldwell, he was on Tucker Carlson recently, did a really good job. I would say the takeaway from that, well, I mean, the whole thing's good. He talks about immigration a lot. He knows a lot about Europe. I would say the second half of that interview is the one you want to pick up on after minute 47. But that's me. What do I know? Here's the table of contents. The revolutions of the 1960s. Chapter one, 1963. That's what we're going to talk about today. Number two, race. That's a bigger chapter, and it's going to be difficult. But we're going to get through it. Chapter three, sex. That's a big chapter too. Chapter four, war. Part two is the new constitution. That's where he talks about chapter five, debt. Chapter six, diversity. Chapter seven, winners. Chapter eight, losers. And that's the end of the book. We'll see how far we get. The first chapter is only 4 pages, so that'll be very easy. We're going to do a transformative reading of this, going to make a fair use of it. We'd like to thank Chris Caldwell for writing it, and Simon and Schuster for making this available. This copy was delivered to me on Saturday, October 30th, 2021, years after Jesus, at 7:31 p.m. And it was purchased by a former political philosophy student of mine named Matt Stone. Thank you, Matt. Matt was in class with Matthias, who came on the podcast, Michelle Fields, who used to be on Fox, and who I reached out to about coming on the podcast. She never got back to me. Her brother, Michael, who later took logic from me, and I had a great time with him. He did expect a little bit of grade inflation, which bothered me and annoyed me, and which I pushed back on, and which he seemed to be annoyed by me pushing back on him. But that's the job of a professor. And anyway, this was at Moorpark College, Political Philosophy, 2008, the year and the semester that my dad died. I like to thank Matt Stone, my political philosophy student from 2008, Moorpark College, fall, for sending me this book, because I requested a certain number of books on MySpace, or sorry, Spacebook. And he responded, and there were several people that responded, probably a dozen. And this was what was starting the Republican professor. So thank you, Matt. 1963. Oh yeah. So let me give you the publication on this. This is Simon and Schuster. This is. I don't think they can. I don't think they know where their headquarters is. They say New York. Then they say London. Then they say Toronto. Then they say Sydney, and then they say New Delhi. I think they're confused about where their headquarters is. That's me. Copyright 2020 by Christopher Caldwell. And you can buy a copy, and I would highly suggest that you do. Can I make a suggestion about how to purchase this book? You could go to Barnes and Noble and just order it, and then that kind of signals to them that there's a market for this kind of material. You could look for it in a used bookstore. That's probably what I would do first. I really think you should get a physical copy of this book and read along with me. Throw some money at Simon and Schuster, reward them for publishing this book. Support your local bookstores and support authors like this. He doesn't make a lot of money. I mean, he deserves way more money than he's getting for writing this book. I can promise you that. But let's be a culture that values books. And that's why I do these transformative readings on the Republican Professor, because I want to model for you and for the younger generation physical books. Don't put a huge company like Amazon between you and what you read. Look, I want you to look. Those who are watching on YouBoob, look, I got this sucker in my hand. Nobody can take this out of my hand. Nobody can censor this. I make my own notes with my own handwriting. It doesn't depend on electricity. Maybe I have to wait for the sun to come up if there's no electricity, but I can read. I can read. It's me and the author and some really careful thought. This was not written by a robot. And it's not manipulated and mediated by one either. 1963, the assassination of Kennedy. In the mid-1960s, Caldwell starts doing a fair use transformative reading. At a moment of deceptively permanent-looking prosperity, the country's most energetic and ideological leaders made a bid to reform the United States along lines more just and humane. What page are we on? We're on page three. They rallied to various lo loosely linked moral crusades, of which the civil rights movement. And have I mentioned what I think about that term, the civil rights movement? It's very misleading. I don't know what Chris Caldwell would say about that, but when you say the civil rights movement, it's very misleading. Very misleading. Culminating in the 1964 Civil Rights Act. The first Civil Rights Act was 1866, FYI. Republicans, all Republicans. By the way, this 1964 Civil Rights Act was made possible by Republicans who supported it by far greater margins than Democrats did. Democrats still had a lot of, well, Democrats were the party of the Klan, so it was harder for the Democrats to get on board with this. But there's more to the story here. So you need to we're trying to get at why Goldwater had a problem with this. Goldwater, Jewish last name, hardly a WASP last name. But just so pay attention. That's what I'm trying to say. Pay attention. We need to do some stuff on Goldwater coming up. They rallied to various loosely linked moral crusades, of which the civil rights movement, culminating in the 1964 Civil Rights Act, provided the model. Women entered jobs. That's back when people knew what a woman was and they didn't act like they didn't know how to define it. Women entered jobs and roles that had been male preserves. Sex came untethered from both tradition and prudery. Immigrants, previously unwanted in the United States, were welcomed and even recruited. On both sides of the clash over the Vietnam War, thinkers and politicians formulated ambitious plans for the use of American power. Most people who came of age after the 1960s, if asked what the decade was about, will respond with an account of these crusades structured in such a way as to highlight the moral heroism of the time. That is only natural. For two generations, the 60s has given order to every aspect of the national life of the United States. Its partisan politics, its public etiquette, its official morality.
This is so good.
Thank you, Chris, for writing this. This is a book about the crisis out of which the 1960s order arose, the means by which it was maintained, and the contradictions at its heart. Pay attention to this. That, by the time of the presidential election of 2016, had led a working majority of Americans to view it not as a gift, but as an oppression. Page 4, the assassination of Kennedy. The era we think of as the 60s began with relative suddenness around the time of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy in 1963. Americans are right to say that nothing was ever the same after Kennedy was shot. You can hear the change in popular music over a matter of months. A year and a half before Kennedy was killed, Stranger on the Shore, a drowsy instrumental by British clarinetist Acker Bilk, had hit number one. A year and a half after the assassination, the musicians who would form Jefferson Airplane, The Grateful Dead, Big Brother and the Holding Company, and various other druggy blues and folk rock bands were playing their first gigs together in San Francisco. San Francisco, San Francisco, San Francisco. This does not mean that the assassination caused the decade's cultural upheaval. The months before Kennedy's death had already seen the publication of Thomas Kuhn's The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, August 1962. Have you read that book? I've read it. I had to read it in graduate school at Biola University, the philosophy and theology of science required course to graduate with your master's in philosophy. Thomas Kuhn's book, which upended notions about science's solidity and a lot of social and political assumptions built on it. Rachel Carson's expose of Pesticides, Silent Spring, September 1962. There's problems with that book, but yeah. Have you seen it? I've seen it. I don't have it, but I've seen it. I've poked around in it. And The Feminine Mystique, February 1963. I have that book. Yeah. Betty Friedan's attack on what she saw as the vapidity of well-to-do housewives' existence. Something was going to happen. The two conflicts that did most to define the American 1960s, those over racial integration and the war in Vietnam, were already visible. In October 1962, rioting greeted attempts to enforce Supreme Court decision requiring the segregated University of Mississippi, by the way, all Democrats, to enroll its first black student, James Meredith. The last summer of Kennedy's life ended with an unprecedented march on Washington by 200,000 civil rights activists. 3 weeks before Kennedy was killed in Dallas, Vietnamese president, I don't know how to say his name, Dinh Diem, was ousted and murdered in a coup that Kennedy had authorized. I need to ask my friend Kent Duncan how to say that. We've actually had somebody on the podcast, one of my co-hosts, who speaks Vietnamese. So, Kennedy's death, though, gave a tremendous impetus to changes already underway. Often people's react to a political assassination as if by collective instinct, with a massive posthumous retaliation. They memorialize a martyred leader by insisting on or assenting to a radicalized version, a sympathetic caricature of the views they attribute to him. The example most familiar to Americans came in the wake of Abraham Lincoln's assassination in 1865, when the country passed constitutional reforms far broader than those Lincoln himself had sought. Only a 13th Amendment to abolish slavery, sorry, not only a 13th Amendment to abolish slavery, by the way, all Republicans, page 5 at the top, but also a broad 14th Amendment, also Republicans, with its more general and highly malleable guarantees of equal protection and due process. Something happened in the 1960s. By the way, why don't we call that stuff he just mentioned the Civil Rights Movement? I'll tell you why. It's because it was all Republicans. And if you hate Republicans, that's enough to not call it that. Okay. I'm just pointing out basic political phenomenology. You just have to pay attention. You just have to pay attention, guys. A lot of you guys are not good at paying attention. Just describe what you see. When people say, this is not political, this is, and what you're talking about is political, guess what? I stop listening to you because you've just shown me that you're not very good at paying attention. It'd be like walking on a used car lot and saying, this is not about vehicles. Going to a gas station, it's not about fossil fuels. Walking into a grocery store, this is not about food. I don't know why people say such stupid things, but they do. And it's called sin, and it's endemic to the human condition. People say stupid stuff, then people believe stupid stuff. Act on those beliefs, or at least pretend that they believe, and cause all sorts of problems for people like me to fix. Keeps me employed, and that's why I get the big bucks, man. You know what I mean? That's why I'm so damn rich that my students have to buy the books for me. Okay, let's continue. Something similar happened in the 1960s. A welfare state expanded. I know that some of you just got excited when I said welfare state. I know. There's a few Democrats that listen to this and they got excited. A welfare state expanded by Medicare and Medicaid, the vast mobilization of young men to fight the Vietnam War, but all above all, the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Acts. The. Yes, the. These were all memorials to a slain ruler, resolved in haste over a few months in 1964 and 1965 by a people undergoing a delirium of national grief. What could go wrong? Kennedy's successor, Lyndon B. Johnson, was able to take ideas for civil rights legislation languishing in the months before Kennedy's death and cast them in a form more uncompromising than Kennedy could have imagined. How are you guys doing? We've got a little bit left. Civil rights ideology, especially when it hardened into a body of legislation, became most unexpectedly the model for an entire new system of constantly churning political reform. This is a statute he's talking about. Link this episode in with all of the stuff we're doing on Bostock versus Clayton County, which is about how to construe the Civil Rights Act of 1964 as it pertains to sex. We're doing a deep dive on that sucker, and that's going to be about a dozen episodes long, maybe even longer. I think we've done five now. It might be more than a dozen when it's all said and done. Well, definitions of what was required in the name of justice and humanity broadened. Racial integration turned into an all-embracing ideology of diversity. See, this is what they didn't really anticipate. Women's liberation moved on to a reconsideration of what it means to be a woman. Awkward. And eventually, a man. It would be like you're making legislation about fossil fuels, and then you redefine what a fossil fuel is to include things that are not fossil fuels and exclude real fossil fuels, which is not the work definitions are supposed to do. But, maybe that's just me. I'm classically trained. What do I know? Women's liberation moved on to a reconsideration of what it meant to be a woman and eventually a man. Immigration, and as the kids say, literally, immigration became grounds for reconsidering whether an American owed his primary allegiance to his country or whether other forms of belonging were more important. Anti-communist military adventures gave way, once communism began to collapse in 1989, to a role for the United States as the keeper of the world's peace, the guarantor of the guarantor of what? No, okay, I'm getting in the chat some questions about my pens. This is Carol Watson's Orange Coast Auction, 1501 North Raymond Avenue, Suite B, Anaheim, California. You can look up Carol Watson's auctions, Orange Coast Auctions. It's wonderful. Firearms and bladed material. Wonderful. This one is, I'm glad you asked about this one, Rifle Supply in Huntington Beach. This is a wonderful pen. I've had that for a while. And then the orange one, which I'm wearing today in honor of fall coming up, is Orange Navy Store. The Orange Army Navy Store on the Circle, 131 South Glassell Street, Orange, California. What does it say on the pen? It says Levi Basic, guns and ammunition, emergency preparedness, boots and shoes, and much more. I can tell you that for sure. It's an old school Army Navy store that still sells guns and ammunition. Praise the Lord. Putting that back where it belongs in my pocket. And none of these are paid sponsors. I'm just answering the question of what pens I have in my pocket. I don't know why your guys are constantly asking me about the pens. Jeez. Just let me read. Let me read. Man. All right, well, here we go. Anti-communism, okay, keeper of the world's peace, the guarantor of the world's prosperity, and the promulgator and enforcer of ethical codes for an international community order, an international order which was sometimes called the global economy. There was something irresistible about this movement, says Caldwell on the bottom of page five. The moral prestige and practical resources available to the young, to the American governing elite, as it went about reordering society, were almost limitless. Are you listening to this? Are you hearing this? This is very insightful. Thanks, Chris.
Do you know Chris Caldwell?
No, I don't know him.
Oh, why do you call him Chris?
I don't know. I just felt like calling him that. All right. There was something irresistible about this movement. The moral prestige and practical resources available to the American governing elite as it went about reordering society were almost limitless. Leaders. Could draw not just on the rage and resolve that followed Kennedy's death, but also on the military and economic empire the United States had built up after World War II, on the organizational know-how accumulated in its corporations and foundations, on the baby boom, which as the end of the 20th century approached, released into American society a surge of manpower, unprecedented in peacetime. And finally, on the self-assurance that arose from all of these things. We're on page six. We just have a couple more paragraphs for the first chapter. The reforms of the 60s, however, even the ones Americans loved best and came to draw part of their national identity from, came with costs that proved staggeringly high. Like what, Chris? What costs? I need to get new glasses. In money, staggeringly high costs in money, in freedom, rights, and stability. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Rights legislation came with costs in rights. Wow. And social stability. Those costs were spread most unevenly among social classes and generations. Many Americans were left worse off by the changes. Economic inequality reached levels not seen since the age of the 19th century monopolists. The scope for action conferred on society's leaders allowed elite power to multiply steadily and, we now see, dangerously, sweeping aside not just obstacles, but also dissent. At some point in the course of the decades, what had seemed in 1964 to be merely an ambitious reform revealed itself to have been something more. This is very important. The changes of the 1960s, with civil rights at their core, were not just a major new element in the Constitution. Now, I would disagree about how he's saying that. It's a statute. It's not a change in the Constitution. It's a statute, Chris, and it can be undone like a statute or fixed, tweaked, modified. They were a rival constitution, and he has a little C, not a big C with that. They were a rival constitution with which the original one was frequently incompatible. He's right about that. And the incompatibility would worsen as the civil rights regime was built out. Now, when he says the word constitution with a small c, I think he's what he means is the identity of the people, the deep beliefs that are driving people, the plausibility structures that are shifting and taking root, false premises that are taking hold in many cases. False premises cause blindness, and we're sinful, so that causes all sorts of problems. So much of what we have called polarization or incivility in recent years is something more grave. It is the disagreement over which of the two constitutions shall prevail. The de jure constitution of 1788, with all the traditional forms of jurisprudential legitimacy and centuries of American culture behind it, or the de facto constitution of 1964, which lacks this traditional kind of legitimacy but commands the near unanimous endorsement of judicial elites and civic educators and the passionate allegiance of those who received it as a liberation. Hang in there, we're almost done. The increased necessity that citizens choose between these two orders and the poisonous conflict into which it ultimately drove the country is what this book describes. And I love that he ends that way. He says, I'm just going to describe it. He's a journalist. He went to Harvard, has his undergraduate degree from Harvard College back before they inflated grades, so he got a probably a pretty good education. He probably studied under Harvey Mansfield. Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. Probably, I would say. He's pretty good at political phenomenology. Political phenomenology just means describing things accurately. That's all. Describing things. And sometimes that's very challenging to do because lot of times people don't want to describe things accurately. It's too painful. Or it challenges some false belief that they have that's very deeply rooted. Thanks for joining me on the Republican Professor podcast. I've been your host, Dr. Lucas J. Mather. Christopher Caldwell is a contributing editor at the Claremont Review of Books and a contributing writer for the New York Times. Don't hold that against him, okay? He was previously a senior editor at the Weekly Standard. Don't hold that against him either. And a columnist for the Financial Times. He is author of Reflections on the Revolution in Europe, Immigration, Islam, and the West. Simon and Schuster. That's The Age of Entitlement, Chapter One. Charlie Kirk died yesterday, and we did a, well, I was recording when I found out. When I was beginning that episode, I had not realized how badly wounded he was. So please don't misinterpret the first part of that episode. The first part of that episode, I really had not looked at the details. I was just trying to get through as best I could, the episode. And I was hopeful that there would be good news coming out later in the day. And then later I had some conversations and people were saying that if you had seen his wounding, that you would not have been hopeful of a recovery. And I don't, I'm just letting you know that I did not know that the ex how I knew he was severely wounded. I figured he would just get help immediately. But I'm not a journalist. I don't mind journalism. It's for me, it's too hard to do it well. My hat's off to real journalists out there. It's very difficult, hard work. I like to do the difficult, hard work that follows up from the work that Charlie was doing. My view is what Charlie was doing is preparing a foundation for, something to be built. Preparing hearts and minds to do the hard work that comes later. The hard work is not fun to watch. The Republican professor is probably not fun to watch. I don't shy away from that at all because it's real. I don't want, you need to be disabused of the idea that getting so-called head knowledge is a walk in the park. The reason I do these readings and the reason that I interact with the readings and interact with guests about what they've written and dialogue Socratically, I could do that same thing. I have done the Socratic thing in classes for a long time. I've taught 190 courses in Southern California at 12 colleges and schools. I've done it officially as a professor. And it's different when you're grading the students. I'm telling you, when you're the one enforcing the reading, making sure they're showing up and, at least pretending to be a responsible human being, as hard as that is to believe. It's very different work from what Charlie was doing. Charlie was not holding people accountable. He was not submitting grades. He wasn't dealing with the satanic administration, which oftentimes just wants to coddle the students and make excuses and find any way of tripping you up and blaming you as the professor for something if you're a Republican. I didn't use the word conservative. I know he used the word conservative. I used the word Republican. Because when you use the word Republican, what do you mean? Well, a Republican form of government. The Constitution. That includes all sorts of notions that we cover on the P Republican Professor podcast that quite often line up well with the Republican Party started in 1894. Sorry, 1854. Who ran the first presidential candidate in 1856 against Buchanan and lost. I think it was Fremont. There's a street named after him in Monterey, California. When you ask if you're a conservative, it's a lot harder to answer that question. Did the conservatives end slavery? Republicans did. I'm a Republican. And if you are holding on to this word conservative as if it's the word Trinity or something, if it's some kind of piece of orthodoxy, I'm going to say that you're misguided on that because human beings are sinful and you're going to have a hell of a time distinguishing sin from non-sin if you're starting with the word conserve. Good luck. It's not very descriptive. You do whatever you want. I'm not trying to control you. I'm just saying this is an argument that I had with my grandpa a lot, and God bless my grandpa. My grandpa was Rob McCoy's mentor, and Rob McCoy is, of course, Charlie Kirk's mentor. Charlie Kirk and I have the same mentor, my grandpa. But I'm telling you, there's a lot of pain there with my grandpa going back. I love him to death. He's not here to defend himself. He died earlier this year. But we went through a tremendous periods of loneliness and isolation to do the hard work of getting what he called head knowledge. And I didn't get any help from my family, a little bit from my mom. Not a lot of help, man. I had to mentor my grandpa and get it through his thick skull that Jesus never denigrated knowledge. In fact, he said, "Love the Lord God with all of your mind." He added the word mind. I'm not saying he added the concept mind. I'm saying he added the word. It's Greek word that was added. And I know that Jesus wasn't speaking Greek. The concept was there in the word heart in Hebrew and in Aramaic. Matthew added the word mind. Fine. Okay. Matthew was reporting what Jesus said and what he meant. Love the Lord God with your mind. With all of your mind. That is hard. That means you have to get some head knowledge, and that's hard. And you're not going to want to watch videos of Charlie Kirk going into the library and reading. You're not going to watch videos of people looking at words on a page. That's why you're not watching this video. But we have to go back to basics, man. I'm doing some work for I'm doing some consulting work here in Southern California for a school. I'm not going to tell you the name of the school. It's embarrassing, man, how far behind they are. They don't have basics down. And they don't know enough to know that they don't have basics down. This is where I'm at, man. This is the job I'm doing. It's like kids that don't know how to write checks. They've never mailed anything. They don't even know what a mailbox is. I mean, it's like basic stuff. The reason I say you should have kids write checks is because it gets them used to signing their name on something and making a promise. And what does that mean? A lot of this stuff gets lost in the internet, and you need to have paper and pen. Okay, you need to train your kids to write their own thoughts, to say what they mean and mean what they say. Make your yes be yes and your no be no. This is basic stuff. Also dealing with the church on church administration where, the some of the people that want to be in the leadership of the church don't have basic knowledge of let your yes be yes and your no be no, that the contradiction cannot stand in church administration. You need to be clear. You need to be lawful morally, and you need to align yourself to the extent that you can with the positive law and the legal tradition. I'm not going to go into more detail on that, but it's a real pain because some of these people I'm mentoring are older than me and they should know better. Just like my grandfather should have known better. But he was mentored badly. And I don't blame my grandpa. He had a single mother who had four kids in the Great Depression. She was doing the best she could. And who knows who else had an influence on my grandfather. But there was a lot of anti-intellectualism flying around. I know because I grew up in an anti-intellectual church until I was in my early teens. And it screwed me up, man. I had to go to seminary, for 6 years and get unscrewed up. Thank God for Gordon R. Lewis, who was my mentor in high school, helped me. Later, my professor of logic in seminary. Thank God. Praise God. There's a lot of kooky, crazy crap out there, and it's very difficult. You need to get a mentor. You need to go back to basics. I want to acknowledge the events of 9/11. And I want to suggest that you check out the interview I did in 2023 with a dear man, a dear man, teaches at Pepperdine School of Public Policy, one of my former colleagues. He wrote In Defense of the Bush Doctrine. Oh, I know, I'm going to get the hate mail. He also wrote one about Obama, criticizing Obama, so you should be happy with that one. But it's a compelling read. And anyway, he defends prudence in foreign policy, and you'll like that. And his name is Robert Kaufman. And I would highly recommend this. And I also want to recommend, and I want to tell you about some work we're going to do on the Republican Professor podcast on tariffs, okay? It's not a topic I want to go through, but we have to. I'm just going to show you some of the sourcing I'm looking at. I want to recommend a podcast to you called Three Whiskey Happy Hour. And there, John Yoo is right there in the Monterey McDonald's. Yes, he's in Monterey in that shot. That's so cool. There's Steve Hayward, and then there's Linda there. She doesn't know me. I don't. John and I have met a few times, and he came on the podcast. He came on this podcast, my podcast. Did a great job. I've never met Steve, but it's a really lovely podcast. I really enjoy it. And I would highly recommend that you follow John Yoo on LinkedIn. He does a lot on LinkedIn. He does a lot, period. And for example, he is a wonderful resource on tariffs. Let me show you just really briefly his link, what I'm looking at on LinkedIn here. He talks about the Federal Circuit here striking down the Trump tariffs. I'm going to take a look at that opinion, and I've already read what he talked about as far, yeah, I know this is really small writing, but this is the Civitas Institute at the University of Texas at Austin, and it's called What Could the Supreme Court Rule About Trump's Tariffs? The reason I'm bringing this up to you is because this has to do with separation of powers and the law of presidential power, which is exactly in line with what he talked about on the podcast in 2022. And it also has to do with the economy, with which for electoral success going forward, Republicans have to get the economy correct. Can't be making stupid mistakes on this. The country depends on it. So there's an interesting balance there between constitutionalism and economic success. We're going to be covering on the Republican Professor podcast, and it's going to be hard, but we're going to do it. Thanks for joining me on the Republican Professor podcast on this September 11th, 2025, years after Jesus. We'll talk to you later.